This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Travolta has a new movie out today. It's called Be Cool, and has him playing, once again, Chili Palmer, the lone shark-turned-showbiz power player he first portrayed 10 years ago in Get Shorty. Both movies are based on novels by Elmore Leonard, and on today's Fresh Air, we'll visit with both Elmore Leonard and John Travolta, starting with Travolta. In Be Cool, Travolta's Chili Palmer is moving from the movie business to the music business. He's found a young and attractive singer he'd like to manage, and visits a club to confront her current manager, a flamboyantly dressed poser played by Vince Vaughn, and he reveals his plans.
Man, the suit. You in town for some kind of convention?
No, but if I was, you'd be the man to see, am I right?
Why would you say something stupid like that?
The way you're dressed, you're either a pimp or a limo driver.
You got jokes? You some kind of weak comedian?
Raji, look at me.
I'm looking at you, man.
Oh, you say you're looking at me, but are you really looking at me?
Well, I'm really looking at you. You got something stupid to say? Say it, so I can be done with you.
Linda's quit. She's out of the chicks.
Man, miss me with that. She's got 5 years left on a contract.
Well, I just canceled it.
I'm walking out of the dark. Who are you supposed to be?
I'm the one setting you straight. I'm Linda's new manager. Come on, honey.
John Travolta's movie career has covered a lot of years and a lot of genres. He starred in audacious character studies like Be Cool, Get Shorty, and Pulp Fiction, disco dramas like Saturday Night Fever, lightweight comedies like the Look Who's Talking films, and action thrillers like Face Off. Terry spoke to John Travolta in 2003 when he was starring in Basic, another action thriller in which he plays a former Army Ranger called in to investigate a mysterious incident involving special forces. Terry asked him if he had to work out to become as buff as his character needed to be.
I did, only because I actually saw these ex-Rangers. I went to school with them for a week to do their exercises, and a lot of the senior guys, the guys that were teaching the trainees, were my age, and they were amazing. They were buff and in great shape, and I thought, oh my goodness, I better get to work. And I chose to be in a t-shirt and tight jeans, and I just felt like it would add to the confidence of the character, because this character, like the men I met, were very confident because they knew they were the best. They knew that they were top of their form, if you will. You
know. So does it help you if there's a real counterpart for a character? If you could go to like a real Army Ranger for your role as an Army Ranger, or you know, a real guy from Brooklyn who loves disco dancing, if you're playing that kind of role, do you need a real counterpart?
Yes.
So what do you do with a character like Pulp Fiction? You know, like
I met with three heroin addicts.
Any hitmen?
And yes, I read biographies of a couple of hitmen, and I did know of one person that would allude to this conduct and never admit it. And I spoke to him. I just heard through the grapevine that this person might, and I interviewed these people because I wasn't going to take heroin, and I certainly wasn't going to kill anybody to study these characters. So I said to one of the heroin addicts that actually was a white-collar heroin addict.
A high-functioning heroin addict.
Yes. Now, of course, both these guys that I talked to in depth were ex-heroin addicts. So.
Oh, right. Okay.
I should make that clear. But I said to the one that had a better ability to communicate detail with me, so like, I can't do this. I won't do it. As much as I love acting and love, I'm not going to go the distance. So you must help me understand the feelings here. And he said, I can't. There's nothing like it. I said, not flunk. I you have to. You have to tell me. Tell me from the onset. He said, okay, this is what you're going to do. Go home. Lay in a hot pool or bath. Get plastered on tequila. And maybe at the peak of that feeling. You will begin to feel the bottom level of what heroin is like. I said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I went home and did that. And I said, okay, I got that. Now tell me where it goes from there. What happens from that point on? So then he began to describe the ebbs and flows, the valleys and peaks, in dramatic detail to me. The scratching, the feeling of warmth that came over the body, and I think crafted the moments that this was happening from the time that the character took the heroin up through his death. So he's what they called a chippy, which was kind of like a weekend heroin addict. And at any rate, he was really wonderful as far as explaining in detail what this experience was like. And then I went with a street fella who was much more kind of dramatic and kind of communicating in a way that I felt was just maybe a hair not really how it was. So I took aspects of how the street fellow talked about it and aspects of how the white collar guy talked about it. And then I put these things together and designed how this would overtake the character.
But there was this kind of hipster thing you had going there too.
Now the hipster aspect is just baggage from earlier, roles even. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So that was the beauty of a Pulp Fiction, was that you had an actor who takes very seriously his craft, and he automatically has illusions that are baggage that worked. It was kind of like putting Elvis Presley in an art film. But all of what he was about helped the imagery. And so the fact that I was willing to play this desperate character with the willingness to reveal my earlier illusions helped make that balloon float and turn what would have been a Reservoir Dogs into a Pulp Fiction, which was much more commercial and viable.
Well, let me maybe give an example of what you're talking about there, which is the twist scene when you're at the 50s diner.
Exactly.
And and there's a twist contest, which is, of course, an echo of Saturday Night Fever. And you're there.
Or Grease.
Or Grease, exactly. And you're there doing the twist. And it's an echo to your dancing roles, but you're still doing it as
but he's high on heroin and he's a hitman.
Yeah.
And yet, because of the way Quentin staged this, it was a mix of reality and fantasy that was a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
But it was all this stuff. Even with Bruce Willis, in his part, he was an action icon. And suddenly he's in a very serious art film doing the things that he does in more commercial-esque type of vehicles. So you really had a very rare and unusual. And it's probably why the movie made history.
I want to ask you about the very beginning of that scene in the 50s diner. When you walk in, you're looking for the table, or for the car to sit in, because the tables are actually cars. But anyways, you're looking for the table, and you're just kind of strutting around the whole diner, looking at the posters on the wall. And it's such an interesting strut, watching you do that. Can you talk a little bit about that walk?
That walk originated from what I observe people to be high from, meaning the shuffle. There was a dragging of one's feet along the ground that the effort was measured, and the feeling was like going through water, you see. And I modified his walk, and I pulled the hair down from the side because he'd been in the car, so I knew that the modified shuffle, which happened actually at the house even earlier when I pick her up, started it from when the camera was in back, because I knew the camera would be in back of me watching. And it was all those little touches that Quentin didn't even notice until he was putting the film together. That shuffle, the heroin shuffle, I call it, you know?
Uh-huh.
and the slowness in how he was observing things. And then, you know, he put his hand up like this and kind of...
Like with one finger in the air.
With one finger in the air and just was hitting the music in his own mind. So it was all like kind of in slow motion.
Oh, yeah.
And that was my version of how he was taking in the elements of this 50s kind of diner slash dance hall.
You grew up in Englewood, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Your father owned a tire distribution company. Your mother taught acting. Do I have that right?
Yes. She was a director, went to Columbia University. She taught drama. She directed. She was also a school teacher. She taught English and speech. And she was quite a marvelous character, by the way. She was very articulate and very elegant and stylish. And my father was a jock and quite appealing. He looked like Cary Grant, and she kind of looked like Barbara Stanwyck, and they were quite the two in the town when we were growing up. They were iconic in their own way in our hometown of Englewood, New Jersey.
Did she teach you anything about acting?
Yes, she did. She taught me about stage presence. She taught me stage manners.
What did she teach you about stage presence? Is that something you can really teach?
Well, no, she thought that you could never teach anyone to act, and she never thought you could really teach stage presence. What she did was that don't be afraid to take stage, which to me was a stage presence concept, meaning like if you had stage presence or not is an inborn natural thing. But when one takes stage, that's a skill. You know, you don't deny that you're on stage. You don't deny your presence, you see. Stage manners, you know, there's basics that we were all taught. And, you know, pretending and acting is believing and all sorts of things like that. I think she liked. It was hard for her because there would be parents that would want her to teach their child to act, and she would say, I can't do that. They either have that gift or they don't, but what I can do is help hone it. And I can give them tricks and, you know, ideas that will benefit them, but I can't make them an actor if they're not.
She must have been pretty happy when she realized you had it.
Oh, my God. She just knew it. She said, oh, my God, all my life I wanted my students to be like my son. And and they're, you know, I think I was her pride and joy in that way. And she had a lot of depth. I mean, you know, she had me late, and she did have...
She was around 42 when you were born, right?
Yeah, almost
43.
Which
was a lot older than it is now for,
now <it's laughs>
for having a baby. Everybody,
exactly.
A lot of people do that now.
Yeah, in that day, it was I was her sixth, and it was unusual to have a child. Although my aunt had a baby at 46, and so it was happening.
So did you act at home, you know, were there little shows that you did at home with your brothers and sisters and your mom?
Yes, we... We had a theater in our basement, and there was wardrobe, and there was music, and there was curtains that gave us the framework to perform in. And we used it like mad. Every day we were in that theater, and we were either lip-syncing to records, or we were creating plays, and of course Mom and Dad were the ultimate audience, as they would sit with their glass of wine and their cigarette or cigar, in my dad's case, and just cavil over us. Most genius things that ever hit. And I just remember hearing the comments and my, oh, Helen, can you believe him? You know, with the cigarettes going, or the certain, oh, geez, that's the best I've seen yet. You know, and who knows how good we were or not good. I just know that they thought we were the tops.
Did your mother ever draw the line for you to say, John, you're not on stage now, so just cut it out?
No.
if she thought that you were either getting too full of yourself or using your acting skills to get one over on her?
Oh,
or to
no,
play act sick was, and stay home from school?
No, she was... You couldn't bull my mother.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? She had an innate... So she knew that, so you didn't even bother putting something over on her, you know. So I can't say that. I mean, I was precocious and demanding and that, but that was real. That wasn't my putting it on. That was just, unfortunately, the kind of child I was. I was a very dramatic child, you know, but...
Meaning what?
Well, let's see. I was just a very theatrical child. I would make demands, you know, if I didn't get certain things done by... have certain things done by certain times. My threats were to run away and to do all sorts of, you know, elaborate, dramatic things too. And they were so smart, they just let... My dad would always say, oh, he's expressing himself. I mean, any other kid would get a smack in the butt or the face, and I was always just, he's expressing himself. So I don't know if it was being the sixth, and they just had tolerance in their hearts, and they didn't mind it so much, but whatever it was... At an early age, I knew it was quite beautiful and that I was getting a big break on this not-so-ideal behavior.
Did you follow through threats?
No. It was pretty bad. You know, I remember once running up the stairs and throwing up the window and screaming like as though I had jumped out because something wasn't happening quick enough or something. And I can hear my mother, bum, 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 bum. And I was hiding in the closet and waiting to see how it affected her. And it affected her so deeply that I knocked it off from then on. No more dramatic behavior. It's the same thing with my father. You know, he's playing the piano one night in the store that he and his brother own. And it's honky-tonk piano. And I decided, I guess I needed some attention from him. So I'm up in the rosters in the attic of the store and I scream as though something terrible has happened to me. And boom, 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 he comes running up just like my mother had. And he holds his heart just like my mother held her heart. And these are moments where you realize how much you mean to them. Yeah. You know what I mean? But it was not kind. You know, I was 8, but nevertheless, I was dramatic, you know.
You grew up in New Jersey where you watched New York television, and on one of the New York stations was Million Dollar Movie, which showed the same movie every day over and over for a week. So of all those movies, I'm sure you watched it. Which were the couple that you watched the most that really meant the most to you?
Yankee Doodle Dandy meant by far the most to me, period. And I watched it over and over again, and I'd cry, and I'd laugh, and I'd sing, and I'd dance, and...
That's James Cagney as George M. Cohan writing.
Jimmy Cagney.
Songs at the Turn of the Century.
Yes.
And being in vaudeville.
And it was an extraordinary moment. Matter of fact, I did an expose in the New York Times, a 5-page. It was the biggest spread they'd ever done in the arts and entertainment section. And
it was part of the Watching Movies With series.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you used to watch The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
That was the other one I loved. Of course, that was almost too sad for me, but I did. You couldn't help but watch it. But it was almost too sad, you know. Symphony, water, and the beautiful girl bringing over the water and dripping it into his mouth. And of course, we would immediately take that scene and recreate it. And I'd be hunchback and put a pillow on my back, and my sister would come along with it and drip the water into my mouth.
This is after the hunchback has been pilloried and whipped and humiliated, and he's just like left there to be made a public mockery of, and the gypsy dancer gives him water after he's crying out for water.
And he's turning, they spin him around on that like Lazy Susan, like turntable thing, and he's so grotesque, but he's so sympathetic. And the beautiful girl comes over and drips the water in his mouth, and that was real filmmaking, truly.
Oh, I have to ask you about Saturday Night Fever, which is a defining film,
sure,
both for you and for the 70s and for American movies. The opening of Saturday Night Fever is a close-up of your feet as Stayin' Alive is playing on the soundtrack. And you see your feet, and then you see your feet in a hipper pair of shoes. and then you see your whole body, and then back to your feet again. When you're doing that now classic scene, which has been paid homage to I don't know how many times in other movies, did you have the music playing behind you? Did you? So you knew the beat that you were supposed to be walking
to? Absolutely,
and
there was a debate about it. There was the producer, Robert Sigwood, wanted me to to not walk down the street to Staying Alive, but to do my solo, my big dance to Staying Alive, and to walk down the street to You Should Be Dancing. And I said, I can't do that. And I'll tell you why. I said, Staying Alive has a slower rhythm. I said, I could walk down the street to Staying Alive, but I can't dance to Staying Alive. But now I could do the solo to You Should Be Dancing because the rhythms are closer, do you know? So Staying Alive, if you remember the beat, you know, you could do a bop to that, you know, walking bop, soulful strut. But You Should Be Dancing, it was like triple time almost, you know? And that was my, he said, okay, deal. If you walk down the street to Staying Alive, I'll let you dance solo to You Should Be Dancing. I said, I'm happy.
So did you have it, were they playing it on the set as you were walking?
Mm-hmm. On a little tiny, well, it was, did you ever see those recording instruments on a set? They're kind of small, and they're just what the sound man uses.
Uh-huh.
But they're almost portable looking, and that was a little apparatus connected to that. That looked like a little radio from a car or something, and a reel-to-reel recorder was being used on that, as I remember it, and it was attached to the dolly that the camera was on, and right underneath the camera was this recording apparatus.
So it kind of moved with you?
It moved with me, yeah.
So is it a walk that you practiced, or did you just know what
to do? It was a walk that I got from school. Because it was really a walk that a lot of the African-American guys that were very stylish used. And us white guys liked walking like that. So we would walk too like that to be kind of hip and, you know, with it. And I thought, I think this character would do that walk that I remembered we all did in school. Again, being in a public school where I wouldn't have necessarily gotten that from Catholic school.
Probably not.
So all my experiences that I remembered, I did bring into play there.
John Woo directed you in the film Face Off, in which you play an FBI agent, and Nicolas Cage played this crazy killer who's in prison, and through complications much too complex for me to explain now, you trade faces through cosmetic surgery and trade identities as well. And so you end up having to do Nicolas Cage imitations, and he ends up having to do John Travolta imitations.
That's right.
When I talked to Nicolas Cage, I asked him what it was like to watch you doing him.
What did he say?
And he said, I wrote down the quote, he said, "His impression of me is pretty impeccable. He picked up the way I tend to elongate my words when I talk. I didn't know I did that."
You know, it is interesting that he didn't know he did that. I always found that fascinating. And
like, how could he not know?
In a way, you know. But I found it endeared him to me even more, because I thought, that's why Nick is so kind of wonderful, because he's not paying attention to himself. He's just being. Do you know what I mean? He's not self-aware in that kind of egocentric way that one would be aware of their style, you know, or something like that. So I was pleased in an odd way that he it was a revelation to him that he did that.
What did you hear in him you picked up on in his speech style or his movement?
Well, he's a very specific walk, which is kind of the legs bow out and they go in front of each other in kind of a, I don't even know what the comparative would be, but it's a very specific, like, outward swing that comes, and almost the toes are slightly pointed in when he does it. So the walk was very specific. And I said, Nick, we should really just go with your walk, because you have a very distinctive walk. And I said, and we should go with how you enunciate and pronunciate words. And he said, oh, okay. And then I said, you know, you will make things like this, you know, you will talk, you know, and kind of, you know, and he giggled in the idea that it was, but he understood it, and so he started to comment on his own style that was pointed up to him, and then we could ride on that to some degree to see, you know. So it was a fun deal, that whole thing, trading valences in a way.
Well, he seemed to learn a lot from watching you do him. Did you learn anything from watching him try to do you?
Yeah, I learned that I'm a tough guy to imitate.
That's what he said. He said you were tough to imitate.
Because he watched all my movies, but what I have is more of a neutral personality. I don't have a lot of hooks to the way I say things or do things. And I kind of tune into characteristic traits of others in order to perform, you know. There's that old English saying about actors, they have no souls because, I mean, obviously it's not true, but I mean, they're kind of become whoever they are, mm-hmm. so they have no identity of their own is what the saying is about, kind of. And sometimes, I mean, I don't feel that, but I understand that because I do feel neutral often before I go into a part, you know, and I maybe put a spirit of play that I have, you know, with friends or family into some aspects of a role or something, but characteristic traits I don't have a lot of specific of, and Nick does beautifully.
Okay, one last question, and if this is too weird or too personal, just tell me, but you're considered very sexy, a kind of sex symbol in a way. Does being the subject of a lot of people's fantasies and being this kind of sexual presence on screen, does that make sex any more enjoyable? I mean, does that translate to real life? Does that make lovemaking like any more exciting?
Well, I mean,
is that a weird question to ask?
No, I know what you're saying. No, I don't have any self-consciousness about it. The question. Let me try to explain something about it.
Yeah.
So you can. I've always been a sexual person. Anyway, but not all my characters have had to use their sexuality. I felt in certain key parts I've used it, and then in others I have not. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so all I can say is it's in life I feel that way, but in acting I only feel that way if the character feels that way. And if there's a sexuality about the character, then I play it, and if there isn't, I don't. Do you know? And there's been, I mean, you know, there's been a certain level of sexuality in different parts I've played. And then there's some where there's just none, do you know?
But does it make you feel sexier in real life knowing that a large part of the public finds you so sexy? Do you know what I mean? Does it make you feel sexier, or does it make pleasure more pleasurable?
I don't know, because I think I felt this way before.
I see what you're saying.
The fame.
I got it.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
I never needed the movies to feel sexy.
Got it.
You see, I think that I had the same effect on people before I made movies. And if I appealed to them personally, And I never knew whether it was just because of who I was as a person, or it was a sexual feeling they were feeling, or it was an emotional feeling that they were feeling about me. And it's very confusing sometimes because you don't know what station a person's tuning in to you on.
Uh-huh.
Is it emotion? Is it spiritual? Is it, you know, sexual? Is it just commonality? Is it common realities? You know, it's a very interesting thing. But whatever it was is what I had before I started portraying that on screen.
John Travolta, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
John Travolta speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. His new movie, Be Cool, opens today in theaters. He returns to the Chili Palmer character he played in Get Shorty, which, like Be Cool, is based on a novel by Elmore Leonard.